With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Can't get enough true crime horror story? Check out our Patreon at www.patreon.com/truecrimehs for early access to ad-free episodes, exclusive bonus episodes, and patron-exclusive merchandise. For as little as $1 a month, you can support the show and help us bring you even more content. Thanks for listening, and let the night roar.
True Crime Horror Story contains extreme violence and adult subject matter. Listener discretion is advised.
I am your host, JD Horror, and this is True Crime Horror Story. Season 2, Episode 12, Flesh for Satan, Part 3. Warning, the following episode contains extremely graphic depictions of torture, rape, murder, and dismemberment. Listener discretion is strongly advised. Part 1, The Satanic Nipple Shrine. In our recent episode on the Toolbox Killers, we brought you the tale of Florence Bittaker and Roy Norris, two sexual sadists who drove around in a white cargo van on the hunt for unsuspecting hitchhikers to satisfy their twisted desires. In this episode of True Crime Horror Story, we bring you the story of another group of men who cruise the streets in a van in search of women. Only this time, our killers would not only use their victims for their sexual satisfaction, they would also use them for ritualistic sacrifices. A ceremonial quest for flesh. Flesh for Satan.
Everybody thinks I'm a monster.
The victims were lone females at night. They were attacked and mutilated and the bodies were dumped.
Everybody thinks I'm a monster.
Cook County Sheriff's Police are also investigating possible links between the three men and unsolved murders in their jurisdiction. This red van played a key role in launching the current investigation. Geck's name surfaced after police stopped the 1975 Dodge van with Spreitzer at the wheel. Spreitzer denied any wrongdoing, but pointed out that the van belonged to Geck.
Everybody thinks I'm a monster. Monster.
They were attacked and mutilated and the bodies were dumped.
Robin Gecht was born on November 30, 1953, in Menard, Illinois. As a teen, he briefly became under the employ of another famous Chicago serial killer, John Wayne Gacy. Gecht was able to avoid ending up in the killer clown's crawlspace, unfortunately for as many as 18 victims. Robin the Ripper, as he would come to be known, was one of those older guys who hung out with a bunch of teenagers. I'm sure everyone listening knows the type. A boy trapped in a man's body, mentally stunted in growth and beaming with immaturity and irresponsibility. Shunned by his peers, he sought acceptance by the only ones he could receive it from, Chicago area teens. The 28-year-old would ply them with alcohol, drugs, and the occult. Gecht was an unemployed handyman, carpenter, an electrician, a real Jack the Ripper of all trades. He had a slew of convictions for small crimes like theft, contributing to the delinquency of a minor, and more serious offenses like auto theft, and there were even rumors that he was once accused of molesting his own little sister. He had three children with his ex-wife, a rather large-breasted woman. Why is that relevant, you may ask? By the end of this story, you'll get it. Robin Gecht would take his time assembling his Ripper crew, seeking out the most impressionable of the youth in his circle. He would eventually find them in 21-year-old Edward Spreitzer and teenage brothers Andrew and Thomas Cucurellis. Robin the Ripper would pile the boys in his red cargo van and head out on the prowl. Edward Spreitzer was a drifter who grew up on the west side of Chicago. He was bullied at school and never got the approval of his stepfather. After crashing the man's car, he was kicked out of the house and bounced around from place to place, couch surfing while searching for work as an unskilled laborer. Brothers Andrew and Thomas worked for Gecht on occasion and were often taken advantage of due to their gullibility and paid shit wages. Growing up, their family was active in the Greek Orthodox Church, and their later involvement in the satanic ritual murders left a stain not only on their family, but on the Chicago Greek community. After a few months of talk, the satanic plan was set into action, and the events that would unfold in the Chicagoland area over the next couple of years would make the gang warfare taking place at the time seem like child's play.
Satanism. To most, it conjures images of medieval black masses or sinister deeds done for the devil. But simply said, Satanism is the belief that evil is excusable and attaining power to control people and circumstances is desirable. Whether you believe in a literal devil is not important in understanding Satanism's effect on our society. The evidence is in. Satan worship and satanic cults are growing rapidly, and adherents of these ideas are becoming more vocal and more dangerous. These symbols of Satanism are turning up everywhere. On walls, on clothes, on album covers, and even on bodies of murder victims. Law enforcement officials admit that satanic cults operate in nearly every community in America. Young children from Oregon to Massachusetts say they've been raped, tortured, and forced to watch small animals killed during satanic ceremonies. School officials in many cities report high school students are forming satanic groups. A Chicago policeman told us, "Satanic crime makes gang activity look like a nursery school."
The boys would drive around looking for easy targets for their satanic rituals. Though we'll tell the stories of the identified victims and their untimely demises, most of the unfortunate souls who lost their lives at the hands of the Chicago Ripper crew were what we refer to as the less dead, usually transients and prostitutes. On May 23, 1981, the crew would take what is believed to be their first victim, Linda Sutton. She was abducted near Wrigley Field, a legendary Chicago landmark and home of the Major League Baseball team, the Chicago Cubs. The boys were driving around when they passed the home of the Cubs, proceeding onto Rush Street, and noticed a 26-year-old mother of two who was walking alone. Robin eased the van up alongside the woman, and they began a conversation. Eventually, he convinced her to get in for a ride. As the Cucurellis boys leered on from the back of the van in a mixture of anticipation and confusion, they headed towards the Brer Rabbit Motel in Villa Park. Robin pulled into the parking lot and suggested Linda accompany the group into the motel. Confused as to what was going on and why they had pulled into the Brer Rabbit lot, Sutton refused. It was at this point Ed Spreitzer, who was awaiting their arrival, made his way out to the van, and at the orders of Robin Gecht, Ed and Andrew dragged the woman into the vacant field outside of the dingy Flophouse Motel. Robin then began to beat Linda without mercy as the teens ripped off her slacks. Ed cuffed her hands behind her back as the leader of the pack removed his own pants and began to masturbate in front of the boys before proceeding to rape Sutton. Andrew watched on in shock as Robin withdrew his flaccid member and exchanged the penis in his hand for a hatchet. He smiled at the boy before raising the small axe into the night sky and bringing the blade down into the woman's chest multiple times. As she lay dying, Gecht dropped the cleaver in favor of a wire garrote, which he twisted around the woman's left breast. He moved the wire back and forth in a sawing motion, enough times to sever it completely from her body. Either she was in shock, silently resigned to her fate, or her screams echoed into the night, reverberating off of the buildings in the crime-stricken community to go unanswered. Linda Sutton's autopsy would later indicate that in addition to her missing mammary, her anterior chest wall and all the skin in front of her ribs and sternum were completely torn off, with several ribs in disarray. Nicks and cuts on the rib bones indicated the use of a sharp object, most likely the hatchet. Though, as you'll come to know throughout this story, anything could be possible with the Ripper crew. Though animal activity during the decomposition of her corpse might have been a possible cause of the missing flesh, the symmetrical nature of the cutting dictated that, most likely, this had been done intentionally. The Chicago Ripper crew would strike again on May 15, 1982. Though it may have been a year later, I want to reiterate that the crew had almost 20 supposed victims, and only 8 of which we have confirmed details to report on in this episode. The likelihood of them lying in wait for almost a full year after such a brutal murder is far-fetched to say the least. Lorraine Lori Ann Borowski, no relation to friend of the show and also Chicago native and true crime documentarian John Borowski, was a 21-year-old receptionist at a Remax real estate office. She left her home at the Elmhurst Apartments on South Fellows Court at approximately 8:15 a.m. on the morning of May 15th. She was wearing green khaki slacks, a white ruffled blouse, 4 gold rings, and an ankle chain her mother had gave her as a present earlier that year. Lori's usual walk to work was only 3 blocks, and when her boss, Don Stribby, arrived at the office to find her missing, no call, no show, he became concerned. Lori was usually at Remax by 8:30 a.m., and Don arrived at about 9. Though Lori was nowhere to be found, there was a random scattering of objects on the pavement in front of her work. Shoes, keys, makeup, some change, and a socket tool. After a few hours, Don was so bothered by Lori's disappearance and the strange collection of items left outside that he called the police.
Miss Borowski is employed as a secretary receptionist at the Remax Real Estate Company, which is located only about 3 blocks from her apartment. Lorraine was to have opened the office on Saturday morning, but her keys, some cosmetics, and a pair of her shoes were found strewn in front of the firm. Friends and associates of the missing woman have been unable to shed any light on the mystery, but police believe that Miss Borowski has met with foul play.
At this point, we're going on the assumption that she was abducted. There's no indication in our investigation for any reason for her to be missing at this point, other than by some type of means beyond her control.
Raymond Borowski, Lorraine's father, says his daughter is not the type to disappear. And Borowski says the family is considering some kind of reward offer.
Both the shoes and the keys outside of the real estate office were identified as belonging to Lorraine Ann Borowski. Just down the street from the office, prior to Don Stribby's arrival, another manager of a business, Frederick Moberly, noticed a red van parked in the lot in front of his business about 50 feet away from the Remax office. Lori had arrived to work on schedule and noticed the red cargo van suspiciously parked in the corner where it didn't belong. She approached in order to tell the occupant to leave the property and was subsequently taken by force. After being subdued, she was dragged into the shitty van, and if you thought this story was disturbing this far, here's where it gets worse. After Lori was literally lifted out of her shoes and into the Ripper crew's possession, the teens drove the van to Geck's house when they knew his wife had headed out to work for her evening shift. The boys then hauled the bound woman up into the attic, which had been converted into a makeshift satanic torture chamber. 6 red and black upside-down crosses adorned the walls, and an altar was placed in the center of a crudely drawn pentagram and covered with a red cloth. She was then lowered onto the homemade unholy communion table. Subsequently, after saying some bullshit incantations, Robin Gecht began to stab Lorraine Borowski at least 7 times. As the life leaked from her body, once again, another woman's breasts were cut free from her torso. They then dismembered her corpse, and it was later dumped at a local cemetery in Darien. After Lori was dead and her breasts removed, the boys knelt down in a circle around their macabre mammary shrine. Gecht read passages from the Bible as each of the boys masturbated, ejaculating into the concave of the fleshy rounds in an effort to fill them up like a pair of cereal bowls from hell. After everyone had finished, Robin would then cut up the stray semen-laden breast into equal parts and distribute it to his eager crew. They would then consume the pieces, gnawing away simultaneously, like a mob of diabolical zombie cannibals. The skeletal remains of Lorraine Browski weren't found until October of 1982 in an unused portion of a gravel road near the cemetery. A neighbor identified the clothes she had been wearing when she left the house on her last morning of work before she had been murdered and dismembered by a van full of depraved maniacs. Identification of the body had to be made using dental records and x-rays due to the state of decomposition. On May 29, 1982, just 2 weeks after the brutal ritualistic murder of Lorraine Browski, the Chicago Ripper crew would strike again. The Mack family were returning home from their family restaurant at about 1 a.m. after a hard night of serving up their traditional recipes. Lynn Mack Zuso and her parents were in one car, while her sister Shuey and brother traveled in another. At one point during the drive, a heated argument began between the brother and sister, and Shuey exited the vehicle. Her brother proceeded home, and when Lynn realized what happened on the roadside, she left home in search of her sister, whom she would never hear from again. Skeletal remains were found in the fall of that year in a wooded area near a housing project in Cook County. Though her body was partially clothed, her sweater and slacks had been cut open, her body splayed and dissected in a manner that the coroner described as cut into ribbons. The next victim of the crew would be spared from death, though it would never be the same after the atrocities that were inflicted upon her. On June 13, 1982, 23-year-old Angel York was picked up by the Ripper crew. She was then handcuffed and pushed into the back of the van, where the men forced her at knife point to mutilate her own breast. The visual drove Gecht into a frenzy, and he drove his own knife into the wound, widening the hole as he masturbated. At the moment of orgasm, he thrust his penis as deep as he could into the shallow cut. When he had ejaculated into the hole, he then duct taped it shut, trapping his little rippers inside of her forever before tossing her out of the moving van. She later identified Robin as her attacker based on his mugshot. Sandra Delaware was the next to feel the blade of the satanic foursome, and she would be discovered on the bank of the Chicago River after being stabbed, strangled, and mutilated. Her left breast had been completely removed, similar to previous victims. She was found with her own bra knotted tightly around her throat, and her wrists were bound behind her back with a shoelace. Sandra had been stabbed in the abdomen repeatedly as the fabric of the bra was twisted tighter and tighter until she was asphyxiated. Unlike the previous victims of the Ripper crew, she was found shortly after she was killed, only approximately 6 hours after the crime. On the 8th of September, 1982, the mutilated body of 31-year-old Rose Davis was found in an alleyway. Her injuries matched the familiar pattern of the crew's victims, as she had also been missing a breast. In addition to the standard fare, Rose's face was beaten so badly that she was unrecognizable. A pool of dry blood surrounded her anal cavity, and a black sock was tied around her neck. She had been both beaten with the blunt end of a hatchet and her breast hacked to pieces. Shortly after the killing, Carol Pappas, wife of Milt Pappas, pitcher of the Chicago Cubs, would also go missing. Though Thomas Cocorales would claim the crew had been responsible, he was unable to lead investigators to her body. Despite his lack of credence, his improbably helpful demeanor was the main reason he was later spared the death sentence when the shit hit the fan. A break in the case would come on October 6, 1982, when the nude and ravaged body of Beverly Washington was found inside of a dumpster near the railroad tracks. Miraculously, though she had been badly beaten, stabbed, her left breast completely removed, and her right breast sliced and diced, Beverly was still alive. She was rushed to the hospital for treatment and was able to describe the gang of men who had committed the savage attack. Beverly described the ringleader and driver as a skinny white guy in his mid to late 20s, who had greasy hair and a mustache and wore a flannel shirt and square-toed boots. Robin Gecht had picked her up while she was turning tricks, and alarm bells went off in her head when he offered her double her asking price for the service he had inquired of her. Despite her intuition, it was an offer she couldn't refuse, and she climbed into the burnt red cargo van. Once Beverly was inside of Satan's sleigh, her John pulled out a gun and ordered her into the back of the van. He cuffed her and forced her to go down on him before making her swallow some unidentified pills that made her pass out shortly after she had taken them. As she was losing consciousness, she saw Gecht approaching with the Garrett and was sure this was it for her. Beverly awoke in the worst pain she had ever experienced, and she was no novice in the subject. Darkness surrounded her, and she wondered if she was in hell. The darkness dissipated with a flash of light, But it wasn't an angel, or God himself, who sought to pluck her from her fate. It was just some random dude taking out the trash who was in for the shock of his life when he found the bloody woman bound in the dumpster. He helped her out of the hellish heap of garbage, and then he called the police. Beverly told her harrowing tale of torture to investigators, and gave up key information that would finally lead to an arrest. She described the van as red, with tinted windows and a wooden divider inside. She also said that a roach clip and some feathers dangled from the rearview mirror, and gave a detailed description of the man who had done this to her, Robin Gecht. Before Gecht and the Ripper crew could be brought down, they would take a final victim who was different than the rest. Their first male victim, 28-year-old Rafael Tirado. Rafael was placing a call in the phone booth located on Northside Street and minding his own business when he was gunned down at random in a drive-by shooting courtesy of the Ripper gang. Just 11 days before All Hallows Eve, Halloween in 1982, a reddish-orange van matching the description given by Beverly Washington was pulled over by Chicago police. The van was driven by a man by the name of Edward Spreitzer, though it was registered to one Robin Gecht. In a search of the vehicle, police uncovered three knives. They also noticed that the inside handle, the rear and sliding doors of the van had been intentionally removed. The door could only be opened either from the outside or with a tool that was kept in the glove box near the front passenger seat. A similar tool had been found in the RE/MAX office parking lot where Lori Borowski had been kidnapped from. Police arrested the owner of the van, Robin Gecht. Though they didn't have enough evidence to deny bail, and Gecht was released after posting up a bond of $50,000 less than a week after being taken into custody. Upon further investigation, they could tie Gecht to the motel where the crew's first victim, Linda Sutton, had been found. The motel manager remembered the wild parties that the Ripper crew had had during their brief stay, and was under the impression that the boys were some kind of devil worshippers who were involved in a cult. The Cocorellis brothers were also implicated since they had registered under their real name. During an intense and exhaustive interrogation, and after failing a polygraph, the weak link of the bunch, Thomas Cocorellis, cracked under the pressure and confessed to everything Robin Gecht and the Chicago Ripper crew had been up to for the past couple of years. He described the rituals, a box containing at least 15 severed breasts, and the seminal communion and cannibalism. Using his testimony, police were able to bring Robin the Ripper back in, as well as his brother Andrew and his buddy Ed. The trial started on September 20th, 1983. A little less than a year since the Ripper crew was taken down. Robin Gecht took the stand and confessed to the brutal attack on Beverly Washington, but denied being the ringleader or being involved with any of the actual murders. He took the stand in his own defense, but was found mentally incompetent to stand trial. Be that as it may, he was eventually found guilty and sentenced to 120 years in prison for attempted murder. Only Gecht himself knows the reasoning behind his compulsion for removing the breasts of his victim, tarnishing the very image of motherhood with his deviant rituals. In an interview, Gecht was quoted as saying, "Well, in answer to your question on obsession with breasts, it's a thing with my entire family, going back, as I'm told, to my great-grandfather. Each of us men would marry large-breasted women. My ex-wife is a 39D, and yes, she was very satisfying to me." Edward Spreitzer, one of Gecht's partners in crime with the Chicago Ripper crew, claimed that Robin once became so furious with his wife that he had cut off her nipples. Spreitzer pled guilty to 4 counts of murder and was sentenced to death, though his sentence was later commuted to life in prison due to Illinois Governor George Ryan's commutation of the sentences of all death row inmates in 2003. Andrew Cocorellis was sentenced to death for his role in the two murders on March 18, 1985, at the age of 23. He showed no emotion after the verdict was read. Until the bitter end, he was convinced that he would not be put to death, being that his role in the Ripper crew murders was lesser than his cohorts. He was executed by lethal injection on March 17th of 1999, the last prisoner on death row to be executed before the pardon that saved Edward Spreitzer's life came into effect. Thomas Cocorellis was convicted of murder, but was given a reduced sentence due to his cooperation with the investigation and implication of his accomplices for their role in the crimes. He was sentenced to life in prison, though was eventually successful in an appeal that dropped his time to a maximum of 70 years in prison. The sentence was cut in half due to his good behavior as a model prisoner behind bars, and he was released from prison on March 29, 2019.
A member of the infamous Ripper crew released from prison after nearly 40 years. The crimes so brutal, investigators compared them to Jack the Ripper and Charles Manson.
Thomas Cocorellis left the Illinois River Correctional Center in downstate Canton at dawn.
You know, this is such a remarkable story, you guys. Cocorellis, likely the only member of the infamous Ripper crew who will ever see the outside world again. His release, extremely difficult to take, as you might imagine, for the families of 18 murdered Chicago-area women. First light and an array of IDOC vehicles make their way around Illinois River Prison. Any one of them could be handling transport for Thomas Cocorellis, transferred discreetly from here to an undisclosed location. At last word, he had no plans for housing. His family, long ago, turning their backs. He originally got life for his role in the murder of a 21-year-old Elmhurst woman in May of 1982, but a rape conviction overturned on appeal and now defunct sentencing rules set him free after serving just half his time.
I thought he was going to be in prison till I died.
For 83-year-old Lorraine Borowski, this brings it all flooding back. The terror and the loss of her daughter, Lori. The four killers committing sick, satanic rituals, rape, and murder, prowling Chicago and the suburbs for vulnerable women.
They thought they were all insane, and I said, how could four guys be insane at the same time? And they hung around together. That don't mean they're insane. They're just evil. Evil.
Documenting that evil, this 17-page 1982 confession in which Cocorellis describes the cult and how its members preyed on women in graphic detail, still too much for Lori's brothers to bear.
It's disturbing because it's not just us. There is... other families...
He took some from me that was very close to me. I live it every day of my life. I'll never forget it. It's just like yesterday to me.
Now, we're being told Thomas Cocorellis will have to register as a sex offender, but other than that, faces no restrictions. He actually completed his parole inside. Outside this morning, opposition continues to build to his release. In fact, this afternoon, famed attorney Gloria Allred and other family members plan to hold a press conference in Rosemont to express their dismay with this situation, his release, and the state of the justice system.
The audio clip you heard in the beginning of the episode.
Everybody thinks I'm a monster.
Was taken from an interview he did shortly before his release. Though he walks free amongst us today, Thomas Cocorellis is a monster, just like the rest of the Chicago Ripper crew, whose crimes will always be remembered by the surviving victims, the families of the dead, and the Chicagoland community as a whole. Their quest for sacrificial lambs and severed breasts for their psychotic satanic rituals demanded pounds of flesh. Flesh for Satan.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Part 2. The Devil's Music. Christmas Eve of 1996 was a cold winter night in Colmar, France. Like so many nights before, 19-year-old David Oberdorf was sitting on his bed, listening to black metal, and staring up at the shitty portrait of Adolf Hitler that adorned the dark walls of his room. According to his own account, he was rocking out when the voice of Satan spoke to him and possessed him in what he called a satanic flash. At the urging of the chorus of demons in his head, he armed himself with a ceremonial dagger and set off into the night. Father Jean Ohl had closed down for the night at the St. Adelphi Church and headed home. He was readying himself for bed when his doorbell rang. Upon answering the door, he was greeted by an unexpected visitor, David Oberdorf. Father Uhl knew the boy. In fact, he was the priest to whom Oberdorf had professed his love and faith in Jesus 2 years before that wintry night. But bearing witness to the darkness in the boy's eyes, Father Uhl knew that he had strayed off of the path of the righteous and was not the same young man who had attended his services. Something in David had changed. "I am possessed by a demon, and I must annihilate men of religion," Oberdorf said as he withdrew the blade and began to plunge it into the chest of Father Uhl. He then gagged the priest before stabbing him over and over, 33 times to be exact, symbolic of the amount of days Jesus Christ had supposedly spent on the crucifix. He suffered greatly for almost an hour, as his lungs filled up with blood and he basically drowned in his own hemoglobin. After the old man was dead, David Oberdorf attempted to carve pentagrams into the priest's palms, but the blade was more decorative than functional, and they came out looking like crude letter Vs before he gave up and fled back into the night. Oberdorf was arrested soon after his crimes and claimed that though he remembered the actions, it was like he had no control over his body. An otherworldly force had used him as a marionette against his will after taking control of his soul that night in his room. Of course, the prosecution ripped this theory to shreds, and David Oberdorf was sentenced to 20 years in prison. After his arrest, he was implicated as an accessory to the desecration of an elderly woman's corpse at the Toulon Cemetery. The body had been dug up and its heart removed, only to be impaled on a spike on the cemetery gate for all of Toulon to see. Oberdorf was an evil young man. He used stories of demonic possession and heavy metal music as a scapegoat for his own twisted actions. I couldn't find any additional info regarding his continued confinement or his release, as 20 years has passed at the time of this recording. One thing is for sure, though. I hope he isn't walking the streets as a free man, like another Nazi piece of shit, former Mayhem member and founder of Burzum, Varg Vikernes. But that's a story for a different day. Part 3. El Diablo Me Dijo. On the evening of Friday, April 17th, 1998, three young men attended a party in the small border town of Donna, Texas, in Hidalgo County. 15-year-old Andres Andy Rafael Chapa lived in Donna, and his 20-year-old cousin, Pablo Lucio Vasquez, had been staying with the family. 12-year-old David Cardenas was from Alamo, Texas, in the Rio Grande Valley, and was visiting his friend Chapa for the weekend. The trio stayed at the party for a few hours, drinking and smoking weed before they left around midnight to go back to Chapa's house. The two cousins made it to their destination, but they were covered in blood. Young David Cardenas, however, though also covered in blood, did not. Pablo Lucio Vasquez, born August 11, 1977, claimed to have been drinking heavily the night of the party. He had also been smoking weed and snorting cocaine. By his own admission, he was pretty fucked up. When the three boys eventually left the gathering, Vasquez began to succumb to the intoxicants. When they reached a wooden shed next to Chapa's house, he told his cousin that he was hearing voices telling him to kill Cardenas. In fact, Vasquez thought that the devil himself was speaking to him. Shortly after, he claimed that he blacked out. He picked up a pipe that he had found on the ground, and when the youngest of the three asked Vasquez if he had any rolling papers, Vasquez struck him in the head. Confused, Cardenas looked at Vasquez and tried to speak, but Vasquez struck the young boy's head 3 or 4 more times. Still, Cardenas was alive.
I started hearing voices in my head, and I told my cousin that sometime he'd kill him. So, that's my cousin, and I hit him, and he fell down.
Where'd you hit him with?
The pipe.
Where'd you get the pipe at?
It was on the floor, like where he was at. Mm-hmm. He looked at me at first, but then, and he put them to me, and like, he just didn't have no feeling or nothing.
Did Andy try to stop you before you hit him?
No. Well, he didn't say nothing. He just looked at it. Like he felt something was wrong with him. So I hit him. And
where'd you hit him at?
In the hip. Somewhere.
What was he doing when you hit him behind the head?
Just looking at him. And then he said something wrong. And I hit him 3 or 4 times. And he was right there. He was still alive.
When you hit him 3 or 4 times, where did you hit him at?
In the hip. He was still alive. And he told me, you killed him. And I go, no, he's not dead, he's still alive. So I went inside. And he was getting active, and the British, I told him we were going to burn him. And he said, yeah. And I got him. And we took him. And Andy had the show.
Vasquez ran inside the house to make sure that the commotion hadn't woke anybody up. All was quiet. Once back outside, the cousins decided that they needed to bury Cardenas. There was just one problem. He was still alive. Chapa happened to have a knife in his pocket that night, and Vasquez grabbed it, using it to slit Cardenas' throat. Vasquez scooped the boy up and slung him over his shoulder, while he gurgled and struggled to breathe, but he was too heavy. Vasquez threw him down and dragged him on the ground a little way before picking him up again, holding the bleeding and still alive Cardenas over his head. During a videotaped confession, Vasquez later said,
I picked up the man, the blood was dripping, and it got all over my face. So I don't know, and something just told me, juke, juke, like, you took a drink of wine in the morning. And you drink what? It's good.
Chapa purportedly vomited at the sight. Vasquez then dropped Cardenas again, and the two cousins dragged him across the road, leaving a trail of blood behind them. According to Vasquez, Chapa then hit the boy in the face with a shovel 5 or 6 times because the poor boy was still alive and trying to speak. Motherfucker, shut up, Chapa yelled. Then he dug a shallow grave and placed Cardenas inside, covering him with grass, scraps of aluminum, and pieces of wood. Then they walked back home, showered, and tossed their clothes, telling Chapa's mother that the stains on their clothing was Kool-Aid. That Saturday night, Vasquez told his uncle Juan that he had done something bad and needed to leave town. The next morning, he fled to Houston. Police found Cardenas' body days later on April 22nd. The sight was gruesome. David Cardenas had been viciously beaten about the head, scalped, his throat had been slit, and he was missing a foot, one arm, and part of his other arm. A patch of skin had been cut back from his back. Vasquez also took a ring and a gold necklace that David Cardenas had been wearing on the night of his murder, but lost the ring and later tossed the chain. During his taped confession, Vasquez claimed that he did not mutilate Cardenas' corpse, that it was probably wild animals. The missing skin on his back, he said, was probably due to dragging him across the road. Vasquez and Chapa did, however, attempt to remove the young boy's head with a shovel. The devil was telling me to take it away from him, Vasquez said, adding that it couldn't come off. An anonymous tip led police to Chapa and eventually to Vasquez, who was arrested in Conroe, Texas, a suburb of Houston more than 325 miles north of Donna. His statement to police about hearing the voice of the devil and drinking Cardenas' blood fueled speculation about Satanism and earned Vasquez the nickname Vampire Killer. But the subject never came up at Vasquez's trial, nor did it in his subsequent appeals. Vasquez was charged with capital murder and sentenced to death in March of 1999 in Hidalgo County, Texas, for the brutal slaying of 12-year-old David Cardenas, a young boy who had his whole life ahead of him, and who Vasquez called an angel during his taped confession. Chapa was also convicted but received a 35-year sentence because he was a minor at the time of the crime. He was denied parole in 2015 and will be up again in December of 2020. Three relatives of Vasquez and Chapa had attempted to conceal the crime, including his uncle Juan Chapa. They received probation and a small fine for helping to cover up the slaying. One of them was deported to Guatemala. Vasquez's attorney, James Keegan, made numerous appeals on behalf of his client. He claimed that Vasquez was not mentally stable and that putting him to death would be amount to cruel and unusual punishment. He also argued that potential jurors who were against the death penalty were purposely excluded from the trial, and that Vasquez had not attempted to rob Cardenas before killing the boy, making him ineligible for the capital murder charge. All appeals, though, were rejected. Pablo Lucio Vasquez was put to death on April 6, 2016, at the age of 38, in Huntsville Prison in Texas, by lethal injection at 6:11 p.m. Before the drugs were administered, he addressed Cardenas' family. I'm sorry to David's family, Vasquez said, as he looked over at 4 of Cardenas' relatives who were there to witness his execution. This is the only way I can be forgiven. You got your justice right here. He was pronounced dead at 6:35 p.m. after a lethal dose of phenobarbital had been administered.
He was cremated, and the location of his ashes has never been released to the public. A senseless crime from a senseless teenager. Could it have been prevented? Maybe. But unfortunately, our series on satanic murders, Flesh for Satan, will continue in Season 3. Because stories like this are as plentiful as the denizens of hell itself.
I started hearing voices in my head. Sometimes I'm killing. So, I picked up the match, but I was dripping. I don't know, and something just from until we drink out of wine in the morning.
You drink what?
It's blood.
Thanks for joining us for the season finale of True Crime Horror Story. We'll be back soon with Season 3. Suggested movies similar to today's cases? For the Chicago Ripper Crew, In the Name of Satan, a 1990 VHS Satanic Panic documentary. For the Devil's Music, Lords of Chaos, a 2018 true crime black metal thriller directed by Jonas Åkerlund and suggested listening, the album Ultimate Unholy Death by Japanese black metal band Abigail. And for El Diablo Me Dijo, the entire unedited tape confession of Pablo Lucio Vasquez is available on YouTube. If you like what you hear here on True Crime Horror Story, please subscribe and give us a 5-star review. You can also think about joining our Patreon at www.patreon.com/truecrimehs, and then stay tuned after this show on Patreon for the True Crime Horror Story After Show with Dom and JD, as well as early access to ad-free episodes and exclusive bonus content available only on Patreon. This episode features research by Lana McCall and MR, and music by Mechanical Ghost and The Quiet Type, and artwork by Nuclear Heat Graphics. Sources for this episode's cases are available in the credit section of our website. Has violent crime impacted you or someone close to you? Send us your story at truecrimehorrorstory@gmail.com. True Crime Horror Story. Sometimes truth is more brutal than fiction. Here on True Crime Horror Story, we talk about some of the most shocking cases in American history. But we always give the listener closure at the end of the episodes when these killers are brought to justice one way or another. Unfortunately, the families of some victims of violent crime don't get that closure. Experts estimate that there are hundreds of thousands of untested rape kits in police and crime lab storage facilities throughout the country. There is no comprehensive national data on the nature and scope of the rape kit backlog. In the Backlog is an initiative to shine a light on the backlog of untested rape kits throughout the United States. Their goal is to end this injustice by conducting groundbreaking research identifying the extent of the nation's backlog and best practices for eliminating it, expanding the national dialogue on rape kit testing through increased public awareness, engaging communities and government agencies and officials, and advocating for comprehensive rape kit reform legislation and policies at the local, state, and federal levels. We here at True Crime Horror Story urge you to learn more about the backlog, where it exists, and why it matters, and to take action and support efforts to test rape kits. Your support can help send the message that rape must be taken seriously and every victim deserves closure. EndTheBacklog.org.